some strange allies. So what do I mean by that? Well, you all know that there's this folk wisdom out there that quantum theory and then general relativity are in a sense very incompatible. So it's very hard to unify them because they are so different conceptually and mathematically. For example, quantum theory is usually, it's a probabilistic theory, whereas GR is a deterministic theory. Quantum mechanics is usually formulated on fixed backgrounds, whereas GR is background independent. Then if you try to combine both with the tools of quantum field theory, you run into a non-renormalizability of GR. So you have all these sorts of problems. And that's all true, of course, but what I will show here is that quantum information theory actually adds a kind of a different perspective or a different facet to this picture, which is in some sense opposite. it tells you that in a way, quantum theory and space-time, so not talking about GR specifically, but more generally about space-time, they are in a sense strange allies. So in a way, they work together very well, and they mutually constrain each other's structure in a certain sense. So by studying one of them, we can learn about the structure of the other to some extent. And my talk consists of three parts. The first part will be something that many of you have seen before. It is about PR boxes. It is about possible correlations between quantum theory and how they would fit into space-time. The second will be about relativity of simultaneity, about an interferometer, and what this could tell us about the structure of quantum theory. And the third one will be about the Lorentz group and what this might have to do with quantum communication. Okay, so for the first part, when I say that they kind of determine each other, I have to argue counterfactually. I would have to say, suppose I would change one of them, then maybe the other would change as well. So things wouldn't fit anymore that well as before. So I want to argue counterfactually, and then I have to say, how could these things be different? And we all know how space-time could be different. Could have, for example, different dimensionality, could be discrete, could have something like torsion and so on. So what about quantum theory? And that's something that people in quantum foundations have thought a lot for a long time. And here's a very simple example, which is just a Bell scenario, where you have a Bell inequality. And here you have a simple setup where you distribute two particles to two laboratories where you have A, Alice, and B, Bob, and they can choose to do a measurement. So maybe they choose to do both measurement number 0, and they get a certain outcome, which might be -1 or +1, say spin up or spin down, or they choose to do a different measurement. And if you have a situation like that, then you can abstractly put it into a very simple picture, where you say you have the two parties. They're sharing this entangled state, for example, which is just a black box. And they have an input to the black box, which for Alice is just her choice of measurement. And the output of the box would be her measurement outcome. And you have the same for Bob. And what you can observe in the lab, if you do it many times, is this conditional probability distribution of the outcomes given the measurement settings. And so in quantum physics, if you want to compute these probabilities, they are just given by the overlap with projectors. And in classical physics, this would just be distributing a correlated probability distribution. And then you would literally have a conditional probability distribution sitting here. So even though these two formalisms are different, classical and quantum, they have one feature in common that's very important physically, and that's the no signaling principle. So basically, it tells you that if Alice in her lab just observes the conditional probabilities, then this distribution P of X given A that she sees does not depend on Bob's choice of measurement. So that's, of course, very important, because if that was wrong, then Bob could, just by choosing measurements, he could signal to Alice. And if they were very far away from each other, like this, for example, then he would, of course, violate the structure of special relativity. It could be faster than light in a certain sense. But that's not true, so you have the no signaling principle for classical and quantum physics. Now, what's a Bell inequality? Well, for example, you can compute these correlators here. You can look at this linear combination, which the CHSH Bell inequality. Classically, it's always upper bounded by the value of 2. But as all of you know, in quantum mechanics, you can get a higher value. Yeah. You can actually get up to 2√2 if you take a singlet state and do certain Pauli measurements on it. Now, here's an idea by Popescu and Rohrlich, but Zittelson looked at this also a bit earlier. So Popescu and Rohrlich asked the following question. They said, well, quantum mechanics has this strange non-locality, but it's still okay. It still fits in the space-time because you have no signaling. So maybe what quantum mechanics allows is the most general possibility that still fits into space-time. So are quantum correlations, that's what they ask, are the most general correlations that are non-local, but do still fit into relativistic space-time? And the answer, which I still find surprising today, is no. Yeah. So you can write down certain correlations, which are called PR box correlations, for example, which also have the no-signaling principle, but they are more non-local than all the quantum correlations. So this means they are not possible in quantum physics. Yeah. And so what are they? Well, I wouldn't describe you physically what they are because nobody has seen them. But abstractly, we have to just specify a probability table. And the probability table looks like this. So if it says that if both parties, Alice and Bob, choose to do measurement number one, then they will always get anti-correlation of their outcomes with probability 1/2 each. But in all other cases, they will always get perfect correlation. And then if you plug it into the CHSH expression, you just find that the value that you get is 4. And this is well known to most of you, but it tells you that you can actually have correlations that satisfy the no-signaling principle, but are more general than quantum correlations. Yeah. So what does it tell you? Well, basically it tells you that there is some constraint that space-time puts on quantum theory, which is the no-signaling principle, but this constraint is not enough to actually determine the full structure of quantum theory. It's just a restriction, but it does not fully determine quantum mechanics. But it's an important restriction. So now when you have that, you can go in different directions. And one research direction that people in quantum foundations took a lot was to say, hey, let's look at other principles that have nothing to do with space-time and maybe narrow things down exactly to the quantum correlations. And this is a very interesting and successful direction to pursue. But instead, you could also ask, hey, maybe we can even find more constraints from space-time alone. So there's not only no signaling, but there are other things that we know about space-time. Maybe this tells us more about quantum mechanics. And this will be the content of the second part of this talk. It's about relativity of simultaneity on an interferometer. So I will come to this interferometer soon, but in order to do this, I have to introduce just a little bit of formalism, which tells you how you could be more general than quantum mechanics. For example, have a higher dimensional Bloch ball. And the idea is that you can have state spaces that are more general than the quantum one. They're usually called the convex operational framework. Just as like one slide on that, one thinks about a laboratory situation where you have preparation, transformation, and measurement devices. And preparation device is something where you push a button, it outputs some physical system in some state. And then the transformation device modifies that state. And since you want probabilistic interpretation, that should respect probabilistic mixtures here, so it should be linear. And then you do a measurement. So you get a definite classical outcome, and the probability to get a certain outcome depends on the state that you had in the beginning. Yeah. And for a classical coin toss, it's very clear to say what these states would be. Basically, a preparation device would just toss the coin, a biased coin in general, and so you will have a state in the end that has a certain probability for heads and a certain probability for tails. So state is just a probability distribution. It's for two outcomes here for a bit, if you have only two possibilities. And what's the state space? It's a set of all possible states. And in this case, it would just look like a line segment. We say here in the middle, probability is 1/2, 1/2 is the fair coin. Here 1/0, that's the state that describes a coin where I definitely know that it's heads. And down there would be a state where I definitely know that the state shows tails. In quantum mechanics, you have the same laboratory setup, but the formalism is different. So the preparation device doesn't give you a probability distribution, but it can give you, for example, a spin 1/2 particle, can give you a superposition of spin up and down. Yeah. And more generally, if it's not a pure state, it could be a mixed state, so you could prepare any 2x2 density matrix. And as we've seen before, and all of you will know this, if you plot or try to parametrize a state space, you end up with a three-dimensional ball, which is the Bloch ball. And spin up would be on the north pole, the state which shows spin down would be in the south pole, and the mixed states are somewhere in the interior of that ball. Okay, But you don't have to have those. You can have just an arbitrary state space, which has a strange shape, maybe like this, which would be neither classical nor quantum. Maybe it would describe something like those non-local correlations, these PR boxes that I had before. But there's one constraint, namely, you should be able to prepare at random. So you want to have statistical mixtures of states, yeah, like a device that randomly prepares omega 1 or 2. And this tells you geometrically that your state space should be a convex set. So if you have two states, then the line connecting those will just be the mixtures of those states. Yeah. In quantum theory, the set is just a set of density matrices. And classically, you just have the set of probability distributions. So this is basically a very, very general framework. And here are some examples. So I've shown you the classical bit state space and the quantum bit state space. So what about a quantum, let's say a classical three-level system. Classical three-level system would just be like a triangle. Yeah? You have three configurations, like here, one, two, three, and just all the mixtures. But a quantum three-level system looks quite interesting. It's not really a ball. But if you plot the set of density matrices, it has all kinds of flats on it, and it's eight-dimensional and very complicated. So it looks something like this. If you look into papers by Tsiolkovsky, for example, you find nice discussions on that shape. But in principle, you could have anything, and that would describe a way to deal with physical systems which predict probabilities for measurement outcomes in a consistent way. Okay, now one special case that's interesting here is the bit case. If you have two-level systems, and then in many cases, it turns out it's natural to assume that they are described by ball state spaces. So that's true for the quantum bit, which is just a three-dimensional ball. And the classical bit is also a ball, albeit it's like a one-dimensional ball, a very strange ball. But it fits into this sequence here. Two-dimensional would be a rebit that we heard from Philip. And actually, the five-dimensional ball would describe a qubit in quaternionic quantum theory. Like quantonionic quantum theory that Adler also wrote a book about. The nine-dimensional case would describe octonionic quantum mechanics, so that would be alternative theories to describe two-level systems. So what I'll show you now, actually, is that the structure of space-time, like relativity of simultaneity, shows you that D cannot be too large. So it constrains your state space. And for that, let's look at a little setup here. So this is a paper with Andy Garner and Oscar Dalston. And we just look at a Mach-Zehnder interferometer where we have an upper arm and a lower arm. And you can think of a particle being either up or down. So this is a two-level system. You have two possibilities. So let's describe it by one of these bit state spaces. Suppose it's described by a state inside a d-dimensional Bloch sphere. What does it mean? Well, for example, it means that if you have the North Pole state, then we definitely know that the particle is in the upper branch. If we have a south pole state, we definitely know it's in the lower branch. And maybe we have a state that's on the equator. And that would mean it's somehow distributed, maybe entangled between the arms, superimposed, I should say. And if we put detectors here and actually measured, the probability to find it up or down would be 1/2 each. So basically, you can introduce the set coordinate in the Bloch ball, and that tells you how probable it is to find it up there. And that's just a simple formula, like z plus 1 over 2 would be the probability to find the particle up here. Yeah, okay, so that's true classically and quantumly, and could be just true in general for one of these state spaces. Now, imagine we have physicists sitting here, and the physicists can maybe put little pieces of glass inside the arms. So they can actually perform some transformations. And let's only look at transformations that do not absorb the particle, anything like that, so that can be reversed. So reversible transformations that you can undo if you like. So what can we do if we put like a piece of glass in one arm? Well, if it's reversible, then you shouldn't lose information. So it should map a state to another state, and it should map the Bloch ball into itself. So basically, you must have a rotation of the Bloch ball. And also, if it's done locally, then it cannot move the particle downwards. So the probability must be preserved that you find the particle up there. And, but this probability was related to the z component, as you've seen here. So basically, this rotation must preserve the z component. And so you have a rotation that preserves the z axis. And now let's make one assumption. suppose that all these rotations that I just described can actually be performed by the physicists. So you can do them up here in the upper arm by putting something inside the arm, and you can also do them, all of them, in the lower arm. Yeah, it's a pretty strong assumption. I will relax that afterwards. So what if we can do that? Well, so we can have a transformation in one arm. Maybe Alice is sitting in the upper arm, Bob in the lower arm, and they locally choose different transformations. Now, relativity of simultaneity tells you the following. It tells you if you fly by with a spaceship and look at these people putting the pieces of glass, then there's one frame of reference in which you see TA happening first, and then you see TB happening. But there's another frame of reference in which it's just the other way around. But in both cases, you should see the same detector click statistics in the end. And this can only be true for all states that you send in if the two actually commute, so if TA TB is the same as TB TA. But we've just said that these transformations are all rotations that preserve the z-axis, and this is just the D minus one dimensional rotation group. And so what you get is that all rotations should commute in dimension D minus one. But rotations commute only two dimensions and not in higher dimensions, so we get this. Yeah.
Marcus, you could try to be both identical and we'll say that TATB frame one equals TBTA frame two. Mm-hmm. Will it change anything, or it will just make your argument more complicated?
You can look at this, so you could discuss what the transformation properties are for different observers. Indeed, that's true. So you have to discuss what possible transformations you could expect. In the end, you would say, having a detector click here or performing TA instead of TB is something like you fly by with a spaceship and you see a soccer match and you see Germany winning or Brazil winning. Yeah, it's just a fact. It just doesn't change. Like it's the same for all spaceships. So you can make a case that this should be a situation like that, where the clicks are just there, and the transformation should just be the identity. Like it's the trivial representation of the Lorentz group in this sense. But we can just discuss this more because it's a bit of a subtle point. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to make a complete quantum description of this, I would have two qubits, one for the polarization and one for the trajectory, and they will be in entangled state.
Okay.
Is it clear that this more accurate representation reduces to this one? I'm concerned about the Z conservation argument and things like this.
Yeah. It's not clear, but I'm just assuming basically that you have a theory that in this case reduces meaningfully to a two-level system where you can distinguish two possibilities. But it's not clear that this always works. It's always not clear. Fundamentally, you would have a higher dimensional state space that has more degrees of freedom, like polarization. But I'm just assuming, suppose I can isolate these two possibilities and talk meaningfully about the resulting state space.
There would be two physical systems. What would be the position and the other the internal degree of freedom?
If you have an internal degree of freedom, then yes. But you can imagine that you could imagine not having one. Yeah. You're not using it in the thought experiment. You're just assessing this one position degree of freedom here. Yeah. Yes?
Is your assumption about not being able to flip, is that like akin to getting rid of the transpose or more? In the more general case, that's what puts the S in front of SOD minus one?
No, not quite. This is really not moving the particle downwards gives you the D minus one in the SO. It tells you that this axis must be preserved. We preserve the probability, so you preserve the Z axis. You could think of allowing an O of D minus one, and then the conclusion wouldn't change. If you start with O of D, you can try with different groups. Okay. So now I'm actually grateful to Chasla for pointing this out to me, that you can relax this assumption. We made the strong assumption that what you can do in both arms is exactly equivalent. So putting in a 5 phase plate over there is the same as putting a minus 5 phase plate down there. It's just identical, but maybe you don't want that strong assumption. Just say that the group of stuff you can do up there and the group of stuff you can do down there, they are just isomorphic, not necessarily identical. And then it turns out that the dimension is upper bounded by 5. Yeah. So this also means that quaternionic quantum mechanics survives. You could have a quaternionic quantum bit, but you cannot have a higher dimensional Bloch ball. Yeah. So in a way, this tells you that you have additional constraints from space-time on quantum mechanics, namely constraints on the number of incompatible qubit observables that you can have. Now, this is also interesting for actual experiments, because there was a paper by Paris where he proposed a test. He said, maybe we have quaternionic instead of complex quantum mechanics. Let's build an interference experiment to test for this. And this is actually being done at the moment by Gregor Weiss. I'm not sure what the actual status is right now, but this is a slide by him in 2013, where they actually tried to perform this experiment. You've read an interference experiment, and you ask, do I have maybe quaternionic or maybe even octonionic quantum mechanics? And given what I've just shown you before, you might say, well, maybe they find quaternionic quantum mechanics and get the Nobel Prize. But I bet quite a bit of money that they will not find octonionic quantum mechanics, because it would have a nine-dimensional Bloch ball, and that wouldn't really fit into space-time structure. Of course, you have to look at the details, how this fits to what we did before, and we're still doing that. It's not easy, but at least you can try to make an informed guess about what to expect and what to hope to find in this experiment. Okay, good. Now, for the third part, the motivation is to ask, could the arrow actually be the other way around? So could it be that, say, under additional assumptions, quantum theory can be a constraint on our space-time? Could this be the case? And this is usually not the way we train to think about this. We're all trained to think about space-time symmetries as fundamental and as constraining the way we build theories. But maybe we can go the other way around. And there are actually hints towards this connection that quantum theory can tell us something about space-time a priori. One of them is just something that the existence of spin. Yeah? I mean, this will sound trivial to most of you, but I still think this is an underappreciated fact. So if you look at that you have representations of the rotation group. If you're in d-dimensional space, it would be SOD. And then it turns out that if you rotate your Stern-Gerlach device, then you rotate your state space, so you have the one-to-one correspondence, actually a group representation of the spatial rotations and the transformations of the state space. And that you can have in quantum theory, like on a two or spin one half state space, spin one state space. But for most other state spaces, it just wouldn't work. Yeah? If you just had any convex set, then there would be no way to have a reversible map on it, which would be a symmetry of that set, which would correspond to a representation of the rotation group. So something's interesting here. At least it's a constraint that you want to have representations of the rotation group. Now, even more, for the qubit case, there's actually a one-to-one correspondence between the linear structure in the state space, which means like you take a line, which is a statistical mixture, and then on the other hand, you have the linear structure on tangent space where you rotate your device. You have this one-to-one correspondence, and I still find that very interesting, and that maybe should tell us something interesting about our world. That's only possible for the standard qubit, and if you have dimension three. But we also have seen in Philip's talk that the three-dimensional Bloch ball can actually be derived from some information theoretic constraints. So if you put all these things together, then it's not clear what that really means, but it motivates you to think that there might be something interesting going on. Also, if you recall Philip's talk, then he talked about GR and its informational essence and the idea that maybe you can reconstruct aspects of space-time by looking at the information flow. Or more concretely, he asked in his talk whether we can infer local space-time symmetry from relations between observers. And since we know that our information theory is quantum, we should look at quantum informational relations between observers and see what they tell us. And now here's one setup that we look at in this paper here that we just uploaded with Philip. And there's also related works by Dakic and Bruckner that you should really read. This is very, very interesting as well. It's still different from what we do here. And this is the setup that we look at. So we have two observers, Alice and Bob, and they have their local laboratories, and they are very far away from each other. They have never met before. So in particular, they were not able to set a common reference frame. And even though they are far away, they can still communicate. They have one telephone line going here up there. Yeah, so ignore this transformation T for the moment, but Alice can call Bob on the phone, and then Bob can also send physical stuff, maybe by mail in a big parcel, over to Alice's laboratory. So this is the general setup. We have two distant observers, and Alice tells Bob on the phone, hey, Bob, please send me the following object. And then she describes some object in classical information, and then Bob says, okay, and sends something back to her. Now, the problem, of course, with this is that Alice and Bob may have never met before, and so they lack a common frame of reference. So if Alice describes some object, it's not clear that Bob knows what she means. So you can actually say, well, there must be some, if I have some physical system, I encode it in some classical description, this is an encoding map phi, and Alice and Bob will, in general, choose different maps of this form. So in order for that to work, Alice requests something and it gets back what she wants. You may have to correct here. You may have to, a transformation that takes Alice's description and moves it into a description that Bob can work out. Yeah, so maybe we go to a simple example. So as an example, let's assume classical mechanics and suppose these physical objects are just billiard balls with a specified velocity. So Alice tells Bob on the phone, hey, Bob, please send me a billiard ball that moves with like 1 meter per second in X direction. Bob says, okay, puts up a really big parcel, puts in the billiard ball that moves in the parcel and moves it over to Alice. Then she opens the box and sees if that's what she expected. Now, of course, if they haven't set a reference frame, a common reference frame, that doesn't work. So in principle, actually, so what you have to do is you have to get a classical message from Alice to Bob. You have to encode the physical velocities in a three vector. You say my velocity is like 0.7, 0.1, and so on. So this is really an encoding map from the physical velocities to R3. And in general, they could choose a very strange encoding. Let's say let's choose some arbitrary curvilinear coordinate system. And then Bob chooses another arbitrary curvilinear coordinate system. And then what you need to correct for this would actually be an arbitrary homeomorphism of R3. So if Alice chooses strange encoding, Bob chooses strange encoding, you have to move one to the other, then this transformation that corrects would be an element of the group of all homeomorphisms of R3, which is pretty bad. Yeah? This is a bit stupid. Because if they want to work together and they want this to succeed, they should be more clever. And we know from physics that they actually can do better. They can both use inertial frame encodings. So classical mechanics tells you there's something like an inertial frame. And then you can use that to define coordinates. And if you have that, then we know that Alice and Bob choose different inertial frames, but they must be related by a Galilei transformation. In fact, since we're only interested in velocities, it's a subgroup of affine transformations. And so if they do this, use inertial frame encodings, then you can put just an element of the affine group here, and then the whole task will work. Yeah. 10 minutes, okay. So in a way, that's better than before, and it's better because the group is smaller. And they have to negotiate on less transformations. And you can ask whether you could do even better, and the answer is no, if you know other assumption that the best you can do. In the setup with billiard balls, classical mechanics, it's the affine group. That sounds like the best thing, the smallest group you can achieve in this communication scenario. And then you would say, well, this is actually something like the relation. So an element of this group determines the relation between the reference frames. Okay, so in general, and this is now the general setup, we talk about a certain choice of object that's to be sent from Bob to Alice, and about some background assumptions, physical background assumptions. And this taken together will give us a minimal group of transformations that correct Alice's description and translate it to Bob's description. You can actually show very generally that if this group, it doesn't have to be a minimal group, but if it exists, then it is unique as an abstract group, very generally in the setup, you can show that. And now, this is quite important, so I don't know if there are questions on this information theoretic task here. So that's the task that I will look at in the next 5 minutes, okay? So, is that roughly clear what I mean by that? Okay, so what we do next is we ask, what if these objects are quantum objects? So let's send, and for technical reasons, stick to finite dimensions, let's send quantum states. So the things that you move here will be just density matrices, n by n density matrices, living on whatever physical system you want. And suppose there are no other physical assumptions that we put in, like none, nothing that can help them. Well, then this task is very, very difficult. So basically, if Alice tells Bob, hey, Bob, please send me psi equal to like 1 over square root of 2, 1 plus 0, then Bob will say, but what's your choice of basis in this Hilbert space? And for every Hilbert space, they could choose different bases. So the minimal group would be very, would be huge. It would be basically no way to win this game at all. So for every Hilbert space they hold in their lab and that they can meaningfully talk about, they would, could basically choose a different unitary that relates their bases to each other. Now, but this is also, this is if we say there's no structure whatsoever out there. But of course, we have some additional structure in our world. And the structure that we have in our world is this one. Sometimes we can measure the same observable on different Hilbert spaces. So we have one device, and we can put in different quantum systems at the same time. So does this help in this information theoretic task to get a smaller, to get a smaller group and make this more easy? And the answer is yes. And that's what we will look at now. So what does it mean to measure the same observable on different quantum systems? Well, pictorially, you could think of this device. It's a physical measurement device. Think of a Stern-Gerlach device. You send him a quantum system. And then the outcome is really a physical quantity. It's not just digital pointer saying plus one or minus one, but maybe it's a deflection here, a delta x, for example. So the eigenvalues of this observable could just be physical quantity scalars. And maybe it's this one device, and you can send in space states on Hilbert space S, but also states on Hilbert space S prime. And you will get different outcomes in both cases. If you have this, then you would call this physical quantity, you could call it SS prime co-measurable. So you can measure it on system S, and you can also measure it on system S prime. How much time do we have?
Right.
6 minutes, okay. Good. So here's an example in our world where we have that. So the observable could just be spin in Z direction, SZ. Yeah? And when we could think of a Stern-Gerlach device, we send in a spin 1/2 qubit, that's system S, or we send in a spin 1 qutrit, which is S prime, and we can both measure them in the same device. It's just the matrices, the Hermitian matrix that describes this measurement would be different in both cases. For the spin 1/2 qubit, it would be this matrix. Spin 1, it would be that matrix. Yeah. So you have one device, but different observables depending on what system you send in. Now, why? How could you have such a thing? So the possible origin of having such a thing might be maybe these systems S and S prime, maybe they interact in some natural way. Or maybe you can use these systems to actually build your measurement device, like you use electron spins to build a magnet in your Stern-Gerlach device. It doesn't really matter, actually, for us. It doesn't matter for us where this comes from. It just says, suppose these devices exist. Now, of course, you need to say, you see a bit more what it means to do the same measurement on two systems. So for example, if you look at M2 here, then this would not be a box where you say it does the same for both systems. What this box would do is it first checks if it's a spin 1/2 particle. If so, it does the Z measurement. But if it's, but otherwise, it would do the X measurement. So you don't want to have that. That would not qualify as doing the same measurement on both systems. So what you need is you need to look at your collection of devices like this, of co-measurable observables. You need consistency conditions that meaningfully tell you what it means that you measure the same observable. And the consistency conditions that we put here are these ones. Basically, it tells you, the first one, for example, if you have a sequence of boxes of devices that if I send in a particular system converge to a certain measurement, then this will also be true if I put in another system. So some kind of continuity condition between the systems. The second one is if you have two measurement devices, the one always gives a smaller expectation value than the other, then this is true for all systems. If this is true for S, then it must be true for S prime as well. And if that's a zero measurement, then this must be true for all systems. So in a way, this tries to put into equations what we mean by the same observable, some, at least something we demand to hold. Now, sometimes we have systems where actually all observables are jointly, like, are co-measurable, and we then call them equivalent. So we get equivalence classes of systems. So here are examples. Let's first look at the examples in that theorem. So example, if I just take the same system, S and S prime are the same system, but I've chosen a different basis in this Hilbert space. Yeah. Or physically, we'll see later, S and S prime could be spins of electrons with different velocities, for example. And you can show that this is the case. If you have that, then the systems must have the same dimension. And the observable associated to one system must be related to the other system by conjugation with an invertible matrix. Okay. So this invertible matrix would be a unitary in the case we just choose a different basis. Okay, now let's, what we do now is we draw an interaction graph. So what do I mean by that? It's basically when we have two systems, S and S prime, we draw an arrow between them if the set of co-measurable observables on them is tomographically complete on S prime. Yeah, so maybe you have an electron spin, maybe you have a spin one spin, and the observables that I can measure in both of them are spin in all directions. And that's enough to determine the states uniquely. I can do a tomography with that. And then you get something like this. You say, well, here are two systems. I draw an arrow between them. Here's, for example, in our world, in our universe, this would look like that, where you can have, for example, a photon polarization qubit. And there are some observables that you can measure for photons and also for massive spin one particles. Are there enough of these observables to determine the state of a photon uniquely? So you have an arrow going this direction. But if you take the photon observables, you can measure them all in spin one massive particle, but they are not enough to determine the state uniquely. So there's no arrow going from here to there. Yeah, okay. Now, what's the interpretation? Well, it helps Alice and Bob to have something like that. So if you have an arrow here, then Alice and Bob can use that to lift their agreement on a description of one of the systems to the other system. You should think of that. So Alice could maybe tell Bob, hey, dear Bob, please send me a putrid state like this. And then Bob will say, Alice, no, I don't know what you mean. We never have set up a reference frame for this system, for this spin one putrid system. And Alice say, you're right, but we have set up a reference frame for the spin one half particle, so for S. And now what you can do is just build the following measurement devices, which work on S as I described to you. Now put in your S prime system, your spin one particles, and then I mean the state which has the following outcome probabilities. And then Bob says, okay, now I know what you mean. And so, sorry, I'll have to be a bit quick on this, but it tells you in this information theoretic task, they can use the structure. And so if they want to transport quantum states and they make this additional assumption that you have lots of co-measurable observables, actually, that this interaction graph is connected, you can start somewhere and go to all other systems, then the group that they have to negotiate on is just the symmetry group of the smallest dimensional root of this graph. Now, if you assume, like in our world, this is actually the case, that there is a root where you can start, which is a qubit, then you get the symmetry group of the qubit, actually the qubit measurement devices. And so what you get is the conjugations with 2x2 GL 2C matrices. It turns out that this is just the Lorentz group times a scaling factor. So basically it tells you in a situation like this, if you have that, then the observers, their descriptions of local quantum physics will be related by a Lorentz transformation and maybe a scaling factor. So I should probably wrap up soon because I'm running out of time. What we also get is we get that all these systems carry representations of the Lorentz group. So if you have a system where all qubit observables are also measurable, then the system will carry a projective representation of the Lorentz group. And for all other systems, they carry a representation of the subgroup, which preserves those observables that are jointly measurable. That would be, in our world, that's the case for the massless, for the photonic polarization qubit. Yeah. where you only have a rotation along the axis of propagation. Okay, the scaling factor, actually, you can interpret this, that Alice and Bob just choose different units. So maybe it's a bit naive here, but maybe Alice uses centimeters and Bob inches. Yeah, then you have a factor between them. So the question is, can we actually attach a space-time interpretation to the Lorentz group here? And that's not clear. We haven't talked at all about space-time. But it's kind of encouraging that there is a physical situation where what we did really fits the physics. And that's basically relativistic Stern-Gerlach devices. And I should really be quick, I think, and not go too into these messy details, but there are some papers by Hans Westman and some other people where they show that in a certain approximation, a WKB approximation, we can meaningfully talk about localized electrons that have a well-defined momentum, that then, if you do the measurement in different reference frame, the observables are actually connected by exactly a form, something like that. So it's a finite dimensional representation of the Lorentz group of the same kind that we got. So this is this would be an instance of the abstract problem that we started with, which really exists in our world. And you can have phenomena like different observers. If this is not a unitary that goes between different observers, then they see different deflections, symmetric or anti-symmetric, depending on the state of motion. And that's all actually true in our physical world, as it seems. Okay, so we kind of reversed the standard point of view here. That space-time symmetries give you representations and operational properties for observers. We can just start with operational properties on observers and their measurement devices. And if we make assumptions on that, yeah, additional assumptions that are true for our world as far as we know it, we arrive at representations of the Lorentz group and also, well, symmetries. We don't know if you can attach the label space-time to it. Yeah. Okay. Conclusions, you can look at this here. I think that's just an interesting question to ask, how quantum theory and space-time might constrain each other's, because it might give you interesting insights into the architecture of physics. Maybe it's something that may be useful in quantum gravity at some point. The common link between two is information theory. I should also say there's lots of related work that I didn't have time to mention, like on quantum reference frames by Giulio, for example, and Rob as well. Then Lucien has worked quite a while on this quantum gravity part, how it relates to these boxes. But the conclusions, okay, so here's just a summary. So these are the two main results that I showed you. And I think I should stop here. Thanks for your attention.
A little comment on the second interesting problem. So I think in 2011 we looked at a related question, namely, suppose that the theory of electron in the sense of two-level system, as you say, as opposed to four-level system, exists in higher dimensions, then you know what are the possible dimensions? Mm-hmm. And as you already indicated, it can only be 3, 5, 4, 9. Mm-hmm. But the price you have to pay is either in Gibbs quaternions or quaternions. And so we should work out that kind of structure in some detail. And it turns out that there's also a decomposition if you study the structure of these groups. Not a difficult analysis, but you see that there's a canonical decomposition of this higher dimensional structure into lower dimensional product structures, where you can have a situation where the component of the spin in extra dimensions completely decouples or disentangles from the component of the spin in real.
I think I've seen this. You look at the trajectory of your spin under time evolution as well.
And then in that situation, it would be extremely difficult. It seems, I mean, our hope was that maybe quantum information might come up with a non-trivial way of testing a dimensional field, especially with it. And we didn't really come up with a clever way of doing it. It would look quite difficult if things get decoupled.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe we just won't comment on this general thing. I mean, we cannot say that we derive the dimensionality of space. Yeah. We know that you could have quantum field theory in higher dimensional spaces and work very well. But what we do, I think, is you get quantum theory and additional assumptions that we kind of like. Yeah. Like, for example, here we have this small system that they have to agree on, the smallest dimensional one. And then we can say something like, what would what say about space? But still, I think this is this tells us something about how these two things are related structurally.
And yeah, no, I agree.
If you can come up with actually proposes.
If we accept the electron as fully resistant, if that's the case, then what's the
Mm-hmm. So if you can then come up with proposals or really testing something, that's of course really good. Yeah.
We have one proposal which has a difference, but when I talk to experimentists, they told me it has resonance. It's too different.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I also have a question about the second part. The less than or equal to five is really cool, I think. So there's this unexpected spin factor in between quantum mechanics and Quaternion quantum mechanics.
All right. Yeah.
Do you know if the experiment being done by Rieder Weiss will it be sensitive to that case, or is it specifically testing 4 or 5 versus 3?
Let me go back, maybe. So I think I'm not sure, and that's a very good question because lots of slides. okay. So that would be this one. So I think it depends very much on the exact, like on the detailed assumptions that you make. Because if you say, just say, I have a d-dimensional ball, I have all rotations, I just see if I send in different states, how much is exhausted, like the vectors, if I look at the linear combinations, how much dimensions I need to embed them or something like this. Then this depends on, for example, which groups you allow to actually happen in between its time evolution. And in this four-dimensional case that we have here is a subtlety, namely, you might think, well, in the four-dimensional case, you can do locally just the SO3 rotations, but that won't work because the SO3 rotations don't commute. And so it's a certain subgroup which also looks like SO2. So it looks just very much like complex quantum theory, and it's a very subtle way only different from it. Yeah. And I really, it's a good question. I don't know if they would detect this, or maybe you don't know it.
It's always a question of what you assume. Like, you assume that what they usually measure is just the interference patterns again. But then you make assumptions what kind of pieces of equipment you can put in front of the slits. And, if these pieces of the equipment are all what you know as a quantum transformation, so you don't have any code. But then you really put all possible phase shift that may be even basis on a different kind of microscopic physics, and then you hope that at some point you will go outside of the quantum states, and most simple experiment will be that you assume that maybe you live in D, and whole sphere of D is equal to 4, and therefore put the piece and you're outside of the block sphere 3 in extra dimensions, and therefore you just look at the purity of the state already, and it reduces because your measurements are from three dimensions. So that's a kind of a simple assumption. But I'm not sure that they will look at the purity of the state, although they probably can. I mean, I talked to them that this will be also interesting, but they really stick to the original scheme of Paris, where you think that the phases are not imaginary, related to imaginary unit I, but also J and K. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is one basic question. When you propose an experiment to test features of quantum mechanics, you just say that actually we know what the outcome of the experiment is because we have called standard model of fundamental particles, where every particle reacts in a totally predictable and calculable way. So whatever experiment you do, we should know what the outcome will be. So what are you expecting a deviation from standard model physics? Or I say no, this would be in agreement with standard model physics, but what actually is it what is the kind of deviation that you expect?
So I guess there are two possible answers to this. Like the first answer would be to say, well, quantum theory is just so important, we use it always, that it's just a good idea in general to test it. in new regimes, in new situations that we haven't done before. Even though you might expect to just be true, yeah, and find that you find agreement with it. On the other hand, you have a similar situation for GR. Yeah. It has passed all experimental tests, basically. Yeah. Everything we do in the lab fits with it. But still, for theoretical reasons, people expect that there's some regime where it breaks down. Yeah? For example, a regime where you hope to have quantum gravity effects come in. And you might say,
so we accelerate of light years across.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I mean, the thing is, if you look a bit at these other
experiments like the one you showed.
Yeah. The thing is, here in this probabilistic scenario, actually, it's cheaper to do something new. Yeah. So, for example, if you look at correlation experiments, then most of them are bipartite with two parties. And now it's well known that there are many of these probabilistic theories that give the same correlations for two parties, but differ from it for three parties. People just haven't looked at the three-party correlation the same way as for two-party correlations. So this might be a motivation to say, well, here's a new regime, which is substantially different from the old one. But we don't need high energy to test it. We just need to enough control on our photons to have three parties and map out the correlations. So I think I wouldn't expect to find a deviation, but it's a cheap way to test it in new regimes.
Can say LHC experiments can show deviations at the level of particles as well.
Not necessarily. No. So, many of these things are very, very, very similar to quantum theory. They all have the same, cloning, for example. They all have time evolutions that can look unit. I mean, it depends on your specific theory, but even setting up something like here, which distinguishes quaternionic from complex quantum theory, is not so easy. Even though people have written books about quaternionic quantum mechanics, and we should know about what to see. So that would mean you could, if it's so difficult to see, then it's just consistent with complex quantum mechanics in most situations. That's my opinion, at least. No? I mean, it's always hard to say what kind of new physics you might hope to find, or maybe none.
First one is, so I really like the fact that you get this times R plus, like this additional scaling thing, because if you think of Lorentz group as something, if you go to GR and think of Lorentz group as something locally, then this additional scale factor is actually moving from Einstein to file theory, which corresponds to having an extra gauge connection corresponding to the scaling. But then you have to come with the argument, with the standard anti-Weyl argument, which means that you parallel transport vector along two different paths that it will change in its length. And this was the argument. So then we go to the discussion of the spectral lines of atom moved through different paths in space-time, mm-hmm. which result in different spectral lines after transformation. So there is the point is that if you consider this R plus seriously as a scaling, as something operational, then moving further to GR can bring some problem. So
no, but I mean this is really just the scaling factor that you interpret as translating between different units here. So it's not really
but you do it locally. Because you do Lorentz transformation locally. So sure. You can do it independently in each tangent space associated to each point. So when you parallel transport, you integrate those changes, mm-hmm. and then you get different answers along different.
So maybe we should discuss this, but I have to say that this is not what we claim here. I'm not saying really.
I'm just saying that the GR extension brings this specific problem according when you have such a group, such a something to consider.
Yeah.
And my other question is more beyond this. So in principle, this setup, you say that specific experimental setup brings a restriction to dimensionality of a space. Yeah.
Well, this plus assumptions.
What we can do with information. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my question is if we drop out the assumption that space-time is something like a container in which we are inside, and space-time is something what is up to be emerging from something like operationalistic quantum theory. Then maybe this says that actually dimensionality of space time may vary from experimental situation to situation, and maybe there may be no such thing as meaningful global dimensionality of space.
Yeah, I think so. So I think we're making a really big jump here. No? So that what you say is really interesting, but it's very speculative. We're not really claiming that we get actual Lorentz space-time from quantum physics. You know? But in effect, what we try to do is actually what you said, namely set up a scenario, and that's this one. Where you don't even talk about the space-time that contains everything. You just make minimal assumptions, say you can meaningfully talk about two laboratories and communication between them. You can sit down, of course, try to analyze what the exact assumptions are that go in there, and there are some additional assumptions. But the philosophy is really start operationally, just and see what you get from behavior of information, basically, and relation between observers. So this is definitely true. But I really want to again emphasize that it's a big step from here to saying we get something like space-time. So there's a lot much more work to be done. For now, this group is just a group that says, how the descriptions of local quantum physics, Alice and Bob, how they are related to each other. Of course, it's tempting to say it should be related to space-time symmetries in the end. There's nothing in this argumentation that tells us that this should be, that this should actually have that interpretation.
One way to see this result is that you assume you have to assume some kind of subset of you had a relation between spin one and spin half particles and so on.
Well, formulated abstractly, we didn't talk about spin there.
Let's say you needed the fact that spin half is like the lowest subset, and you look at the minimal group. Isn't this just from the fact that two representations of one category group in four dimensions, which have spin half, spin one, and so on, and you're basically recovering the fact that we have a subset of Poincaré group, which is Lorentz or something.
So what you say now basically is, I think, let me go to one of the last slides. Yeah. You say, what you just mentioned is, what you're doing is just this here, which is a standard point of view. You could say, well, there are these space-time symmetries out there.
Yeah, so
they allow you to...
You're reversing that. Or...
Reversing, indeed. Yeah.
So
indeed.
From this end, I guess that there's a Lorentz group.
Indeed. But, well, yes, you get it. But the thing is, these operational properties, when you ask, suppose I have these devices where I can put in different systems, it doesn't matter where they come from. And no matter, maybe you have some fundamental theory that you start with, and as soon as you get these devices, then you can do this argumentation. But it doesn't have to be that these devices come from some underlying space-time, as we usually think about that.
It's kind of like, you take whatever we see in nature, and you recover the data representations of Poincaré group or Lorentz group.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So I think that if there is some very urgent question, it can be asked on the break. Oh, my laptop is dying. So he says also that we have to have a